read the title of my address tonight is the quotation from the Gemara Megillah. Megillah, which I think Megillah is called the book of the Nikah Tigeres, is also called a letter or an epistle. It's Jewish destiny, the life of the book of Esther. Igeres, the term Igeres in Hebrew, is simply a chronicle, a tale of events. Its excellence consists in honest, objective, and precise recording. The prerequisite Igeres must meet, comply with, are objectivity and honest and precise recording. Again. Subjective coloring or slanting of events, omission of significant facts, or vice versa, overcrowding a narrative, a chronicle, with irrelevant details are unpardonable from the standpoint of the historian. And mind you, I'm not a historian. The Shibboleth of Igeres as a chronicle of the historical narration is emes, nothing else but the truth. Yet the emes, the truth, with which the chronicler must comply, belongs to that kind of truth which we expect, I mean according to the law, who witnesses aided to conform to in any case of litigation or court proceedings. The truthfulness of the aid of the witness is of a descriptive, matter-of-fact nature, concerned with exact, impartial, and detailed observation. The introductory phrase "Vayidu Meir HaShlerish" has, when did it happen? So the answer is "Vayidu Meir HaShlerish." Fixing the time of the event, all those events which the Megillah is about to narrate happened in the time of HaShlerish. Second, Igeres is more than a tale, at a higher level, more than a descriptive chronicle recording dry facts, naked, isolated events in chronological order. It's more than that. Igeres, at a second level, contains not just a story, but a living history. At the first level, that of description and observation, Igeres is just a story. It's not history as yet. At the second level, Igeres becomes history, and history is living. Igeres, at the higher level, is not only informing, as it is at the first level, but interpreting as well. It addresses itself at the second level, not only to the platitudinous, fact-prying, gossip, enjoying, excuse the colloquialism, nosy instinct, but to our knowledge-questing, inquisitive mind as well. Igeres, even at this level, does narrate, certainly. Yet its main task is to explain, not only to tell a story. Igeres at that level not only describes, but also interprets. It links up events, sets them up against their proper causal backgrounds, and points out their fundamental patterns of development. In short, at this stage, Igeres is not a descriptive chronicle or story, but interpretive history. Our rabbi said, Gemara Megillah, Nikra Sigeres, Shimhitim Boshlei Shachutim Kshero. The scrolls must be held together by stitches. Three at least. Of course, the stitches symbolize the unity of the tale, the causative unfolding of the events, interpretation. At this level, the ideas, emet, truth, with which the Igeres at its higher level, as I said before, must apply, is related to interpretation rather than to observation. As we have explained before, it is a truth achieved not just through careful, cautious observation, but through correct thinking, profound analysis, and thorough understanding of events. By simply listening to the heartbeat of history, it is the kind of truth which is binding not on the witness, as the case was before, but on the dayan, on the judge, who in contrast to the head, to the witness, is interested in the causal nexus of events, in motivation, interrelatedness, and interaction. The truth in this context is not descriptive, not matter of fact, but inventive, and I would say creative. What is Sefer vis-à-vis Igeres? Sefer in contradistinction to Igeres at both levels signifies certainly a book. But when the Gemara says Sefer, the Gemara had something else in mind. It's not just a book, but it's a book written under the impact of divine inspiration, under the impact and influence of Ruach HaKodesh. It's a prophetic book. Sefer, as an inspired book, is not interested in a story, nor is it concerned even with history. If history be understood as the science of individual events, as one as the science of one timely occurrences that took place once and vanished into oblivion. Sefer, if it's a part of the Kisvei HaKodesh and the canon, is concerned not with individual events, but with universality, whose truth is not limited to a single epoch or particular set of circumstances that will hardly repeat itself. As I said before, for the Sefer, history ceases to be a science of the individual particular single event and becomes the metaphysique as the universal, general, symbolic, the constant and the perpetual law. Events for the clinical, they are events. For the safer, they turn into symbols. For the clinical, historical figures, the actors in the historical drama are people that live and die. For the safer, historical figures that lived once upon a time become archetypes or prototypes whose image is stamped time and again upon all those who emerge in the historical arena. Thus, the Sefer does not tell us the story of yesteryear of an individual who lived and died long, long ago, or of a community of a certain day and age. But Sefer tells us the perennial old new story of human destiny in general and Jewish destiny in particular. Sefer moves events from the particular, from the transient and the one-time way toward the universal, steady, omnipresent and dynamic in the great drama of human destiny. At this point, the idea of truth transcends that of factual observation as well as that of causalistic interpretation and reaches at the level of the Sefer into the realm of inspiration. Truth at this stage is of a predictive nature. To be truthful means to be inspired, to enjoy clairvoyance. To see in every individual fact the fingerprints of universality, in each passing phenomenon, to see in each passing phenomenon what a certain historian Ranke called once the trends of the centuries and the traces of the millennia. The Sefer sees in every individual fact the reflection of the internal, of the inevitable, and in each plot, the manifestation of the elan vital of human and Jewish destiny. The truth of the Sefer is revealed, not discovered. Be held as a vision, not just inferred by logical judgment. Numa gever shemeya imrike, asher yachaze shaddai yachaze, leifel ruhi moidi. Word of the man whose eye is true. In short, Megillas Esther as a Sefer is a part of the Sefer Asfarim, of the canon of Tisvei HaKodesh. It is, I would say, an halachic book. My mind has expressed itself. Arihi Kayemes, the scroll of Esther, will be as permanent like the five books of Moses, and like the statues of Torah Shemoteh. in Tzenarachim, replete with rules, principles and criteria which should guide us as human beings and as Jews. And tonight, when I gave my topic, the theme of my address, I did not foresee the difficulties which I'll encounter in writing this paper. But once I said I had to implement my promise, I wish to analyze just a few ideas which are relevant to our present involvement in the contemporary struggle. The Jews are now involved in a strange manner in the struggle between the two titans, the East and the West, two systems of government, two societies, two communities, two philosophies. I would like to try tonight to interpret our unique position, in particular, and the struggle and the clash between the two titans in general in terms of Megillah Esther, to study contemporary events in biblical and halachic categories. And I warn you, there is a subtle analysis I wish you would pay attention later. You think, how do I know it's subtle? Perhaps it's bad. So you'll be the judges later. Let us just get a glimpse first, before we get involved in metaphysics, into the story of Esther. The story of Esther tells us in the most lively fashion, with a tinge of refined yet biting sarcasm about paradoxical events. Forgive me again the use of the colloquialism. I would think crazy then. With that description, which are both tragic and comical at the same time. We are told a story about of a king who, as our rabbis Chazal have already remarked sarcastically, killed his beautiful, beloved young queen. It's quite possible she was his bride. Had the suggestion, and the suggestion of his friend, Memuchan. It's quite possible that Memuchan was humble in person. And later, short time later, hanged his best friend, or the same friend, who in the meantime succeeded to rise to the top of the Persian hierarchy, upon the complaint of his beautiful queen and bride Esther. It is a strange story, which is bold, as I said before, sad and funny, about the king, per se, neither wicked nor cruel. Chazal say he was not too intelligent. But the story about the king, who signed upon the spur of the moment a decree, an edict, to exterminate a people whose identity he did not know, and about a people, to destroy a people, about whom he simply did not make any inquiry. And a short time later, forgot the whole incident, became very indignant. Then Esther told him what the content of the edict was. It is a story about a commonwealth where many races lived many languages that are spoken, many rituals and cults practiced. It is a story about a pluralistic society, there's no doubt about it, culturally, religiously, which suddenly decided to commit genocide for one reason only. The people who were to be exterminated were abiding by the religious statutes and laws that differed from those of other people. Something else is puzzling. It is almost frightening. It is a story about millions and millions of people among whom there were certainly countless liberal-minded, decent individuals who accepted the satanic, bloodthirsty, murderous, rarely lived indifferently in cold blood. It's a story about a conspiracy of silence agreed to by the entire population of the great Persian Empire. No one interfered. And mind you, it's very simple. It was permissible to demonstrate in Shusha. Not what I've heard. I've proved that it was permissible. It's quite obvious. Mordechai did parade in the streets of the capital, wrapped in sackcloth, with ashes on his head, and he cried with a bitter and loud cry. Mordechai even demonstrated in front of the royal palace. No guard blocked his way, yet no one else joined him. Neither friends, he certainly had many friends, nor stranger. The city of Shushan was perplexed. The Jews did not believe. They refused to face reality. The non-Jew did not care. Moreover, the story is puzzling from another viewpoint, because of a very strange coincidence. A short time before, the entire population was invited to the 7-day feast on the grounds of the royal palace. The invitations were extended to everybody, without a single exception, Jew and Gentile alike, to all races, faith, because the Megillah states in unmistakable terms, "L'cholorom amintzim b'shushan abiro," and to all the people who were present in Shushan. They, of course, as guests of the king, fraternized, drank toast, shook hands, and hugged each other. And a little later, the ruthless, inhuman edict was issued and sent hastily with the couriers to all parts of the commonwealth, Lehashmi, Lehari, Dulehari, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. And the question, rises spontaneously, how was it possible, we ask ourselves, that the same friend just a week ago, or 2 weeks ago, before, shook hands with them, paid compliments to each other, and drank together, and ate together, and feasted together, should not raise their voice in protest? There is a very cryptic remark in the Megillah. Horotzim yotzutrufim bedvar ha-melech ve'ados mitno v'shushan ha-biro ha-melech ve'homon yoshu lishteis v'yoshushan ha-recho. The post went forth in haste, and the decree was given out in Shushan, and the king in Haman sat down to drink, and the city of Shushan was bewildered. Not in grief, as some translations render it. Novecha means the new world. The king and Haman celebrated what? I don't know. You can tell me, I will be grateful for you. by 15 on a one. I read somewhere, I don't remember where I was, that the dignitaries of the Nazi Party, after they had completed their work on the famous Weissensee document, doing the final solution of the Judenfrage, feasted until dawn on Frankfurt and beer. Hashverus like to wine, they like beer. They were Germans. I believe that many questions rise, and I don't have to enumerate them. And I also believe the same questions are applicable to a more recent event, to a more recent epoch. It's almost a replica of what the Megillah tells us. The one difference only, as far as the story of 2,500 years ago is concerned, it was just a conspiracy, which has never been implemented. In the 40s, it was not just a conspiracy. It was a reality. I don't like to complain. I don't like to ask for justice. I don't like to simply to tell the world, I mean, how cynically it acted. I would like tonight, as Spinoza said, not to cry, neither to cry nor to laugh, neither to criticize, nor to approve or to condone, but simply just understand. And here we are coming to a metaphysical analysis of man. I would like you to listen carefully. The answer to that riddle can be found in our philosophy of man as a dual dichotomous being, burdened with an inner contradiction and intrinsic conflict. It's within him. I said it on another occasion. It wouldn't do harm, I mean, to repeat it. Yahadus, Judaism, has never accepted the so-called two-valued logic developed by Aristotle, whose foundation is the principle of contradiction and also the principle of the excluded middle. And Aristotle, in all simplicity, and if we can afford to be simple, we can't afford. We are complex natures. And that if there is A and B, and A contradicts B, so either A is wrong or B is wrong. Both cannot be right. I said that quite often in the halachic realm, I'm simply speaking now about the halachic concept, we ignore the Aristotelian principle as matter of physics does today as well, in the field of nuclear physics. Both principles are Aristotle as being not abandoned but completely suspended, if necessary. The principle of contradiction and the principle of the excluded middle. The halacha has known that secret for a long time. And the halacha many times accepts both A and B, even though A and B are mutually exclusive. The halacha believes that dovar v'hifuche, both can be true. But there is a possibility for a contradictio in the adjecto or objecto to be true without negating the truth of the opposite papers. I could prove it to you on purely halachic grounds if I had more time tonight. Don't get scared of nothing. However, in the halakha it is true, but not fundamental, not basic. We could get along with the halakha even with the Aristotelian principles, even accepting the principle of contradiction and that of the excluded middle. In Jewish philosophy, it would be impossible simply to understand or to comprehend the very essence of our world outlook, of our Weltanschauung, without abandoning or eliminating the Aristotelian principle or the Aristotelian two-valued logic. Let us now, pay our attention to man. Allah had a dialectical approach to man. There was a thesis, and there was an antithesis. On the one hand, Yehadus looked up a man with a sympathetic, appreciative eye. Indeed, I would say with admiration. Could you tell me whether the term admiration is in the proper context? Did Yehadus admire man or didn't they? What do you say about it? I said admiration. Should have stopped me. Is there a manifestation of admiration and great, profound respect for man? Of course there is. I believe it is in Psalm. Psalm Chesed, not 8. It's 8, or perhaps I make a mistake. Chesed. Kings, but at Chasreyu Me'at Melekim, Rekoveid Vo'odor Teatreyu. He's one bit lower than the angels, and he's surrounded with dignity and majesty. Yehadus has time and again expressed faith in him. Not only Yehadus has admired him, has also expressed faith in him, and believed in the human uniqueness, in his royal status in nature, in his contemplative, meditative powers. After all, Yehadus said, he is the only rational being in the universe. Perhaps you'll find some, a distant star, who were there. That this thesis, that Yehadus had a sympathetic, optimistic approach to man, is correct, can be attested by something else, proven by something else. And I believe this proof is incontrovertible. The fact that Yehadus has granted man moral freedom, but complete, unrestricted, unqualified moral freedom. The human being enjoys unrestricted moral freedom. God does not want to interfere with man's liberty, to plot his own existential course. Apparently, man is deserving of freedom. Were man undeserving of freedom, he wouldn't have received that grant, the most precious of gifts, which God had bestowed upon people, upon the human being, upon the world, upon creation. It has not been granted to any other future. And moral freedom, according to the Rambam, to Maimonides, is a tenet of our faith. In spite of the fact that he has not included moral freedom among the Shleish Esrei, the 13th article of faith. On the other hand, Jehadus stricket man with extreme caution. I would say even suspicion. The reason for the Judaic skepticism concerning man is due to our historical experience and our long memory that have been hunting the Jews since time immemorial. Namely, the experience and the memory that man who is endowed with divine rationality may come at a moment's notice into either a non-rational or even an irrational being. And therefore, you have stood all extravaganza of man in stride. I was never too much impressed when man did go berserk. I was never stunned, amazed, or taken aback watching the latter man suddenly run amok. There is, in the opinion of Yehadus, no element of surprise in man's abrupt changes and unpredictable transformations. His unpredictability is a part of his humanity, and I would say his unpredictability is predictable. I just said that man is a child, man is a rational being. But he quite often, frequently, man comes into either a non-rational or an irrational being. So let me now analyze it. And here the analysis begins. It means that man has three alternatives, three options. Either can be a rational being, or it can be a non-rational being, hyphenated of course, and if he wants, it can even become an irrational being. What do these three alternatives represent? Rationality, non-rationality, and irrationality. In order to understand exactly what is meant under non-rationality in contradistinction to irrationality, we must inquire into the source of the threefold schism in the human personality. We may ask what causes the threefold split, the triple conflict and feud within him. What lies at the root? The following lies at the root. Man is a limited being. He is born with finiteness. He is a finite being. And he is aware. He is simply burdened with finiteness awareness, where he himself experiences his finiteness. It's not something which has got to be told to him that you are a finite being, a restricted being, a limited being. He knows it, if he wants to know the truth, that he is finite. It's an awareness. he experiences existentially, metaphysically, his incompleteness and imperfection, his closeness to nothingness. He knows that his power is restricted. Knowledge, will, vigor, ebbing with age. Years, his years are numbered, successes few, frustrations many, and in general his existential prospects are bleak at best. Per se, it is a metaphysical awareness, it's not a psychological one. It is a metaphysical, it's an existential awareness. It's a part of the greater awareness of that I exist. I exist as a limited being. I exist as a finite creature. I exist as an imperfect and incomplete being. However, this metaphysical awareness, this existential awareness, it's not psychological, like our consciousness of we exist is not a psychological one. It's much deeper. It lies at the very root of the human psyche. The human psyche may express that awareness of I exist. But the I exist is the very root of our mentality and our psychological constitution. However, this knowledge, even though metaphysical, finds its expression also in psychological experiences, in disordered moods, in man being dissatisfied with himself, disenchanted with the world, and who is not disenchanted with others, with themselves, fools are not dissatisfied. In being angry with everybody, including himself, it expresses itself in the restlessness of the young, I mean not the young, American of 1969-70, I mean old-fashioned restlessness of the young. It's not something which you have discovered. I was also restless as a young boy, but I expressed it in a different fashion. I might say in a more dignified fashion. But there was dissatisfaction, there was rebellion, there was insurrection in me. In the restlessness, I don't know whether I do it now, but girls used to do it. Lock themselves suddenly up in a room, bury their heads in pillows and cry for no reason or no reason to justify that movement. This knowledge of finiteness, of imperfection and incompleteness finds, as I said, its expression, manifestation in young boys disapproving of their parents, young boys hating Pa and being contemptuous of Ma, and parading and striking and demonstrating. It finds its expression in the loneliness and desolation of the elderly, and also in the fear of the middle age, who are about to become old, to get old. There are no reason, if you investigate, if you investigate all those moods, and they are passing moods, but nevertheless real, you wouldn't find any, you would not discover the theology, so to say, or the causal background of such moods. Because they reach much deeper. They go back to the awareness, the I exist awareness, which is both affirming and negating man. I exist, yes, affirming, At the same time, I exist as an imperfect being, as an incomplete being. All those moods, all those experiences, we call psychological experiences, reflect the fundamental awareness of man, of being incomplete, finite, and therefore consider his existence unwarranted and unjustified. I know what many of you think now. I'm a pretty good mind reader. I'm among my, as far as my pupils are concerned. Rabbi Soloveitchik has become an existentialist. True or false, I don't know, perhaps I am. But I'll tell you, if I am an existentialist, I'm not a Sartre or Heidegger or Jaspel brand. I am much older. You know of who's? Of Sympathy, of the books of Sartre. If there was an existentialist, and the greatest of all was the Sartre. And he spoke about the finiteness awareness, the awareness of incompletion, of incompleteness rather, and imperfection. What name did he point for that awareness? Not such a fancy name as finiteness. I don't know whether the term is grammatically correct. The depth, the profundis, out of which his cry rises to heaven. He also speaks about Minamitzar Korosiko, from the straits, because straits are narrow, but from existential narrowness, Korosiko. What are those Namamaki? What are they? Not peace. What is that Minamitzar? What kind of straits are they? Of course, what are those Minamaki? What is that Minamitzar, if not the experience of finiteness or metaphysical distress which abides in man? Interestingly, as the Zohar speaks, of 10 ma'amakim, 10 aspects of the human awareness of incompleteness. Of course, I'll speak later about our halachic approach to the problem of the finiteness awareness, the problem of Namaki. By the way, you wouldn't find it in Arabic. But there is an Halachic interpretation and also a solution to the problem. Because as I'll explain to you later, we Jews have accepted that. We've never rebelled against it. Mother man. When I say modern emperor, the word modern is not fitting because it goes back to the Greeks of old. The tradition which, it's an old tradition which modern man has accepted as the point of departure for his world outlook and Belfast. Modern man rejects the finiteness awareness. He does not look upon himself as if he were engulfed in Ma'amakim. He does not look upon himself as if he were, so to say, in the straits, all as it seemed, no one to help him to get to the land, or to get his freedom. Modern man wants to be more than he is in reality. He attempts to reach himself. He wants to achieve vastness, boundlessness. He resents boundaries in general. He wants to disobey stop signs and to rush toward infinity, particularly. Mother man hates defeat. He cannot take defeat. Neither the individual nor the community can take defeat. Can our country take defeat in Vietnam? When people storm the gates of the White House, they don't understand that it's humanly impossible to take defeat. Defeat is imposed upon a human being. He never accepts it. Accepts it voluntarily. And that's why America cannot just get out of Vietnam. It's not a political statement, it's a metaphysical
frightened man, and man is a frightened being. Modern man
interesting that the point of departure is the same. Yet, the path leads to opposite objectives. The point of departure is a simple one. The death experience, or the fear of nothingness, or we may say, the finiteness awareness, it, or as the psalmist calls it, mimamaki, is inextricably intertwined with the I exist awareness. One has to pass through the light of the existential awareness, of the I exist awareness, in order to get to the chilling darkness of non-being of the grave. If one could stay forever in the beneficent twilight of a non-reflective grave, please listen carefully, of a non-reflective matter-of-fact being without soul-searching, without meditating, without trying to equate being with knowing, and without subscribing to the old idea that real is only who knows himself to be real. If man could wait, in other words, if one could suspend or at least dim, obscure, the I exist awareness, he would not have to be burdened with the fear of death or the finiteness awareness or the awareness of imperfection or incompleteness. But the question rose immediately, how can one suspend, or at least eclipse, a bit, the I exist awareness? Because when a man enjoys his being in existence, then he begins to think of the opposite destiny of his. The answer was, first, by abandoning the moral norm which is implied in the finite I exist awareness. In the finite I exist awareness, there is a moral norm. I exist for a certain time, for a very short time. My span of life is limited, and I am burdened with a task which I have to accomplish during that short span of life. In the I exist, there is another awareness implied. I exist, and I am duty-bound to utilize or take advantage of my existence to make my contribution. I'll speak later about it. Yes. There is a moral norm. The moral law is intuitively implied in the I exist awareness. I crossed this valley only once, and during my journey through this world, I should leave my mark, and I should leave traces. I should accomplish something. So first of all, if one wants to abandon the moral norm implied in the I exist awareness, then he will dim the awareness. The awareness will not be as intense and as overpowering. But how do you abandon the moral norm? Simply by intoxication or drunkenness. I don't mean intoxication with alcohol, drunkenness, with whiskey, but actually by intoxicating oneself, by the rapturous, hypnotic, hedonic experience. You know what hedonic is, but pleasure experience. It's not as nice as hedonic. Which overpowers man and which takes him out of the world of flowing time, of prospection and anticipation. For orgiastic man, time is reduced to one dimension, the present moment. Of course, the obscuration of the I exist awareness and the surrender to hedonism, which is exciting and perplexing, is a result in the loss of rationality. Man is disciplined, courageous, and resents deceit. He wants to stay in the illumined spot, even though by enjoying the dazzling light, we will have to cast a glance into the yawning abyss of horrors. Rational man does not escape from reality, notwithstanding the fact, the unpleasant fact, that the final reality he must encounter, is death. Rational man experiences being as a normative moral affair. I exist in order to accomplish. Orgiastic man forms the aesthetic society, the orgiastic society, whose prime objective is to enjoy and not to be aware either of being or non-being. The hedonic society is non-reflective, non-meditating, non-introspective, non-self-appraising, or self-searching. The hedonic society is more or less a democratic society. It's a Western society. In pursuit of pleasure and happiness. And that society, if you want simply to break down into world philosophy, its world outlook, its Weltanschauung into its component parts. So this democratic society is in pursuit of pleasure, insists on minimum government interference in private life, resents controls, demands unrestricted freedom in matters which don't affect the community, particularly, it is true, particularly matters of sex morality, hates discipline imposed from above, not even by teachers, is opposed to any threat, to any conscription, and does not like to pay high taxes. The motto of the orgiastic society, or call it as hedonic if you have mercy on the society. I call it orgiastic society because our society is orgiastic. The orgiastic society, the motto of the orgiastic society was formulated long ago. How long ago, would you say? How long ago? Think of Chodesh Tahar HaShem. The hippies and the hippies did not discover it. How long ago, what do you say? Huh? Since when? ਦੋ ਤਰ੍ਹਾਂ ਨਾਲ ਦੇਖੋ ਉਸ ਆਮ ਕਿਸ ਨੂੰ ਹੈ ਵਾਹਿਗੁਰੂ ਬਿਨੈ ਅਣਕਿੰਨ ਬਿਨੈ ਸੋਦਮ ਕਿਤੇ ਲਈ ਸੈਨੋ ਵਾਹਿਗੁਰੂ ਲੋਸ਼ੀ ਨਿਕੇ ਆਸ਼ਾ ਬਹੋ ਐਂਡ ਦ ਸੰਸ ਆਫ ਦ ਮਾਈਟੀ ਸੋ ਦ ਡੋਟਰਸ ਆਫ ਮੈਨ ਦੇ ਆਰ ਫੇਅਰ ਐਂਡ ਦੇ ਟੁਕ ਦੈਮ ਵਿਦ ਦ ਵਾਈਵਸ whomsoever they chose. What should be emphasized, underlined in that statement, in that verse? What would you underline? Of course, the Mekina Shabbachahu. What the Torah underlines is the phrase, not the right fair women. This itself would be so bad. But the freedom from any norm, normative system, interfering with human agony, no authority, this worldly or transcendental, may legislate how men should enjoy life. As long, of course, that they'll admit, as long as it does not infringe upon the rights of others. Orgiastic man does not only respond ruefully, enthusiastically, to inevitable biological urges. This wouldn't be bad. Whose fulfillment yields pleasure, but experiments with the idea and how to precipitate new pressures and unheard of, newly contrived artificial situations which help you challenge the body to respond by engaging in gratifying action which is completely unnecessary. In short, our Western society is the typical representative of the aesthetic society, which actually originated, the real founder of the aesthetic society. Who is the real founder? You speak about founding fathers. Who is the, here happens to be a founding mother. Who is she? Had of course. Vatevo isho keteva ito maho, v'chitavo ilo enoim, the Nachman Zareen Oei Prahaskilu, Vatikach Mipiryei Vatecha. In that moment, Western society was founded and incorporated. Actually, the one who took the charter out for the Hedonic society was Eve. To tell you that the Torah hated orgiastic men, not only resented, hated, abhorred, is unnecessary. And the censure or the rebuke against orgiastic men or Hedonic society was formulated in the Torah where? Where? Where do you say? No. Left side. People sit on my right. I believe the rebuke or hedonic life was censured in the 10th commandment. The Sachmot. Thou shalt not covet, shalt not desire something which is beyond your reach. One must not stretch out his hand for sense infinity. Spiritual infinity is great. Sense infinity is corrupting and abominable. For carnal boundlessness, for the vastness that the flesh demands of man. The Torah teach condone pleasant a pleasant, happy, and gracious life, provided that enjoyment is bounded and the call of the blood is moderate. One may pursue pleasure according to our viewpoint if he knows how and when to retreat and withdraw. How many times did the Torah, how many times did Hedonic society come to the foreground, to the surface, as far as the accounts of the Pentateuch are concerned? How many times does the Pentateuch record it? The emergence of hedonic society into the historical biblical arena. How many times? Probably four times. Orgiastic men appeared, and God, who is patient and kind and benevolent, punished him severely. Of course, the first was Eve. The second, of course, the orgiastic society, orgiastic men of the Ramamu. Not the fair. Huh? I can't hear you. About the Zomu, speak later. They deserve special attention. I don't believe that Zom belongs to the group. The Zdom society was orgiastic, or perhaps, but not. Tibur Tataro. The people in the desert, and they shouted and demanded flesh, meat, quail. They were overcome by lust. And the wind from the north started up, swept quail from the sea, and threw them over the camp. And the people sat together in quail all the day and night. The meat was still between their teeth when the anger of the Lord blazed forth. And finally, the fourth time, the famous Baal Peor episode by Yochanan Mizneis as Bnei Smeov, the people began to commit adultery with the Moabite women. And now we should emphasize something. When I speak of orgiastic men or the Hedonic society, I'm not referring exclusively to carnal hedonism, to real hedonism of the flesh, like gluttony or promiscuity. I don't refer it exclusively. I don't refer to what is known in medieval scholastics, and I always find it hard to pronounce, as concupiscence. You know what it is? I don't know. It's more or less. It's more or less it's something like that, anyway.
More or less what? What do you think? More or less
As a matter of fact, and let us be truthful, Western world is addicted to this strange, let me see again, concupiscence. Western world is lusty, is in pursuit for pleasures of the flesh. The whole sex morality, so-called sex morality, I'll be candid with somebody. Can I test what I say? Western world is addicted to this kind of DNA. Many European, and I may say, I mean, not my patriotism should not, I'm a patriot, but an American, but many European, particularly Scandinavian countries, have reached absolute proportion in their liberality and legislation pertaining to sex morals or sex habits. However, when I say hedonery, this is too even old in the sense of the Greek term, when I say hedonery, I refer to human questing for all goods of the senses. If the element of boundlessness or the drive for infinity, for vastness, or the element of overreaching oneself, of trying to grab more than I can consume, is present. Whenever with the fantasy, because it's an aesthetic experience, it's also an experience, a fantastic experience. Whenever the fantasy begins to stimulate man and to stir in him unqualified yearning for the finite goods of sense, they are good, but are finite, and they are not goods of the spirit, they are goods of the sense. Be it money, be it large estate, be it lust, sex lust, be it delicious food, be it social prominence, the so-called publicity. Wherever desire, unlimited desire, rises, orgiastic man emerges into the arena. The miser, even the miser, kind of a miser described by Gogol, other, who keeps on turning up gold coins, who without spending a nickel on himself, starving, dressed in rags, is also, in a funny way, orgiastic. He belongs also to the hedonic society. For he cannot satiate his hunger for God. And if there is no satiety, then man is orgiastic. Whether orgiastic man is industrialist or thinker or a Casanova or Napoleon or even a great scientist, doesn't matter. What is important? The daily imagination weaves a halo around goods, finite, a halo of infinity around finite goods of sense. And they find, they are mistaken, but they think they have found self-fulfillment in finite goods of sense. And tell me now, isn't the Western society, I mean, the hedonic society, who tries to find self-fulfillment in the finite goods of sense? There is another society, because there is another path, I told you, which human beings take in order to escape from the finiteness awareness. in order to engage in self-deceit, not only in an illusion, but simply in a delusion. The second path, along which frightened men, another man, travels in his wild flight from finiteness, death, leads, as I have said before, in the opposite direction. Instead of dimming, one orgiastic man dims his awareness, his I exist, and I must accomplish awareness. Instead of dimming the I exist awareness and surrendering to sensuous rapture of living, man attempts to enhance and to exalt his I exist awareness. Man at this stage, traveling along the second path, tries to overcome the fear of finiteness through a big lie. You know, the method of the big lie was initiated, by Goebbels, taken over by Khrushchev, transmitted, transmitted to Brezhnev, little by little handed down to Western society as well. Through the big lie, through convincing himself that he is more than man, through intentionally magnifying 100-fold and exaggerating and lying about human ability and power to solve both scientific and metaphysical problems of humanity by simply painting in iridescent colors and the eschatological age which should be brought about by man alone through his wisdom and creative effort. I believe that you know what I'm referring to. In a word, man wants to defeat, who travels along the second path, who wants to defeat his anxiety concerning death, his finiteness, through setting himself up as a deity, powerful, wise, and creative, the awareness I exist, expanding to a larger awareness, I do exist as creator, as mighty ruler, legislator, and final authority. This method has been employed by all humanists. I mean, those humanists who wanted to replace transcendental morality with man-made morality. It's certainly true of the Marxist world outlook. It's to say that Marxism has taken an optimistic approach to man does not suffice. They adore man, not only admire but adore. And they not only idealize man, but they idolize man. And by idolizing man, setting him up as a deity, no wonder that there is that a certain idolatrous cult develops there from time to time. Like the cult of Lenin, of Stalin, the present cult of Lenin, the cult of Mao Zedong, and so forth and so on. Because basically, fundamentally, they try to overcome human finiteness, human imperfection, by idolizing themselves. Of course, if alcohol, I mean, it was hard to find a proper term how to describe that man. I call him arrogant man, maybe that's good. Arrogant man who wants to erase his finiteness experience through self-idolization, his attention, he must shift his attention from the individual to the society, from the single person to the group, to mankind, because idolizing the individual would be nonsensical, they are fair. The latter, society, mankind, humanity, is idolized, deified, and set up as the omnipotent deity. For humanity as such, no single individual, will, in the opinion of self-sufficient, arrogant man, redeem itself from bondage. Only mankind itself can accomplish to liberate itself. The idol is the class, not the individual. Of course, the individual who is idolized is the image of the class. He's so to say, the substitute for the class. He represents the class. But through Lenin, through Mao Zedong, and through Stalin, the class was idolized. This very arrogant society is unfortunately not pleasure sick. Oh no, not at all. On the contrary, an ascetic streak runs through this society. In the name of some doctrine or code, man-made of course, they appeal for sacrifices. They are low in conscience, in contradistinction to Western man, who abandoned knowledge. They are low in conscience and duty-oriented. Western man has forgotten his duty means. In the name of a doctrine, on behalf of an ethical code, which was legislated by man, they are out to conquer or destroy the world. There is no third option to them, there is no third alternative. The human made man is ultimate. Every human formulated doctrine becomes a credo, an article of faith, whose cogency must not be doubted, and woe to the writer who doubts the absolute cogency and veracity of a Marxist doctrine. So, in other words, arrogant man becomes a tyrant, and the society turns an arrogant society that he establishes turns it into a tyrannical society. The tyrannical arrogant society is bold and aggressive, trampling upon individual freedom and personal dignity. The arrogant society scoffs at human faith in God, and considers faith in a transcendental existence as a human weakness. Arrogant man is well organized, disciplined. Their undertakings are bold in design and daring in execution. Did such a society exist? In Babel, of course, the day after all, this is arrogant tyrannical society was portrayed in Chumash by the Tayyar of Love. It's a very strange generation of words. Let me just read two verses from the Chumash. And they said to one another, come, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime for mortar. And they said, come, let us build a city and a tower with its top in heaven. It is hard sometimes to identify whose words we just read. How did the words spoken by fanatical, vainglorious men of old of antiquity, or by some communist leader of today? Arrogant men, while orgiastic man is non-rational, arrogant man is irrational. Why? And I want you to understand, non-rational man means simply, man simply has cast off, shed his rationality. Irrational man means a man who has a rationality, but a funny one. Irrationality is very rational. There is reason, my brothers, to irrationality. There is no reasonableness to non-rationality. But there is system, there is continuity, there is unity, there is consistency to irrationality. Non-rational man rejects norms. Non-rational man is basically an agnostic. He refuses to accept a transcendent law. However, he knows well that the norm legislated by him is of no value, is relative. Non-rational man is not destructive, is not satanic, is not diabolical. He's simply a fool. Non-rational man, orgiastic man, hates evil. He certainly does hate evil, even though he lacks the instrument to check it. But there is one instrument to check evil. This is the transcendental law. By rejecting the transcendental law, man has lost the instrument with which he could check evil. Arrogant man is irrational because he is satanic, diabolical. He legislates norms, defines doctrines, formulates articles of faith, and ascribes to all those irrational things ultimate worth. There is something else. Irrational man may write, not only may write, he had written already a code of immorality. Immorality itself becomes a norm. Murder may turn into a noble deed within the frame of reference of irrationality. Nazi Germany is the best example. Many who killed Jews, who burned Jews in the California, thought that they are actually accomplishing something. They are conforming to a great moral norm and are implementing the moral law. While agnosticism is non-rational, metaphysical arrogance, which leads to idolatry, is irrational.